Blog Talk Radio. All right, Hep Cats and Hep Kittens, we are back, and I am your host and cruise director, Madam Perry. Welcome once again to Madam Perry Salon, and you know I love that doorman. Got so much stuff going on right now. You know, we've had so many good shows, so many great guests, and so many more to come, and it's, of course, all thanks to you, because I really appreciate your support when you subscribe to Madam Perry Salon on either Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast FM, Last FM. When you subscribe, when you download, when you share with your friends, you keep it going and help me to keep getting great guests to entertain you. And I appreciate all your comments and your messages and suggestions. And tonight is also going to be a great night. But first of all, you know, coming up next week I've got Maggie Lynn Heron Heidel, and she is a sci-fi fantasy writer who has a couple of web TV series as well. And she called in when Terrence McNally was here. And, so definitely looking forward to that. Also next week, on Tuesday, you have Mae McCarthy. When Mae McCarthy was on here last year on Madam Perry Salon, she was talking about finance. You know, she's been a television contributor about finance for a long time, and this book, though, is about forgiveness. And do you think forgiveness can not only give you, just a better feeling, a better life, a better spirit? She said there are some tests that show, some studies that prove it can also make you smarter and more efficient. So we're looking forward to having Mae McCarthy back to tell us about that. But tonight, I am so excited to bring tonight's guest. You know, I've been bragging, I've been talking about this, and yesterday I was at a cookout, and the first thing someone said to me when I came in was like, well, you've got an interesting guest on there tomorrow night. I said, yes, I do, and I'm very excited. She is a New York Times best-selling author. Some of her titles are Wages of Sin, Fortune Hunter, Wasted, Breaking Point, Secret Sex Lives, which I subtitled a year on the fringe of American Sexuality. Kind of reminds me of our other Susie that's on here sometimes, Susie Parker, who has written a lot of nonfiction as well as fiction, and she even took some time to do a book research on American Sexuality. Very interesting. I got two Susies. I wonder if there's like a twin connection or something. I don't know. But I am so very glad to introduce you to my guest, Susie Spencer. Susie, welcome to Madam Perry Salon.
Thank you very, very much for having me. When I hear Madam Perry, I think I'm back in my sex research. You know, like the madams in the world of bondage, domination, and sadomasochism.
Call me madam, and I don't mean Pearl Mesta, okay?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off there.
Oh, no, this is great. This is a great beginning, yeah. I like it. I can roll with the improv. This is a riot. Because the funny thing you say that, because I used to, when I had a jazz band, I would say something like, I introduced the band, you know, this is the bass guy, the guitar, drummer, and I'm your host and cruise director, Heidi Fleiss. So, yeah, it's kind of, it's like a throwback, so.
Well, and it's also interesting that I'm sort of flashing back or whatever that when I, because we're going to talk about Andrea and Rusty Yates, the reason I was free to do that book is there was another murder that happened, and it involved the world of sadomasochism. And I actually pitched the book to my agent because it had everything she told me she didn't want. And I just sort of pitched it as a joke. And she went, yes, I want, we want that. We can sell that one and everything. And then we got an offer on it, and I turned it down because I went, I just cannot live in the world of sadomasochism for a while. And instead, then a few years later, after the Andrea Yates case and everything, and I needed some laughter, I turned around and started writing about sex and the world of bondage, domination, and sadomasochism.
For laughter, you say? Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
So kind of like going on about crime, and then you need to sort of cleanse the palate with something else.
Yes, I guess that was my sherbet or whatever, huh?
Oh, or your coffee. You know, when you're sniffing different fragrances, they give you the little coffee grounds to sniff to kind of, you know, so that the scents don't mingle, you know, in your olfactory system, so that it kind of freshens that. Very interesting. You know, you've got I'm just so amazed, you know, going through everything that you've done. I've been reading your books for years. Wages of Sin. Thank you. And I'm going to tell you something else. I'm a big fan of true crime, and some of your sisters and brothers in the genre have been on here that you know, Catherine Casey, Diane Fanning.
Yes.
Matt Phelps. Michael Fleeman, and they're just absolutely delightful folks. But I never say this to the guys, but I tell the women, when the women are on, I say, you know, as many true crime books as I read, because I'm just fascinated by human nature and what people will and won't do and what people think they can get away with, you know. But there often seems to be, not with all males, but with some of the male authors, there always seems to be a point in the books about two-thirds of the way through where I start feeling like the guys are just, like, adding in words, like they've got a word count to fill. Not all the guys, not everybody listen. But with women, I never feel that way. It's like everything is, you know, it's only what you need. And everything
there,
you need. But just...
There is some filler in my first book, Wasted, which my editor insisted that I put in there. And the interesting thing is, that's the part people say, is it interesting in the book? You know, it's like some technical court stuff or something, and people say, oh, why did you put that in there? It's so boring. And when I read it, I went, oh, why is that in there? It's so boring. So, but that's the only book that I had filler in. The rest, it's cut, 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 cut. In fact, Diane Fanning, I think it was on Breaking Point, the Andrea Yates case, I had just too much in there, and Diane helped me cut some stuff.
Oh, she's fantastic. I really like her because, yeah, Wasted was the first of your books that I read way back, and then I also read Wages of Sin. It's quite a world. I don't know if what draws you to write about true crime.
I actually fell into it. I had no desire to write true crime, but a friend of mine came to me and said, there is this really trashy story, and you have to write it. And I went, why? Why don't you write it? Because she was from Atlanta, and, you know, she's a writer, and she always considered herself an Atlanta blue blood. And so I kind of always thought the book, which ended up being Wasted, was probably, she thought, was beneath her, but it wasn't beneath me, a Baylor University student, you know, or graduate. And so I, you know, my career was going nowhere. I really wanted to be a novelist who was a cross between Larry McMurtry and Jackie Collins. But that was going nowhere, so I did a little research on the Wasted story and thought it seemed pretty interesting, and the prosecutor on the case sat down with me, and then a friend of mine many months later called me up. I left a step out. In the meantime, I sent a letter, this was back in the days of snail mail, to an editor I knew, and said, oh, happy birthday or whatever, just chit-chatting about life, and then said, oh, by the way, I'm researching this book, and gave her a one-sentence synopsis on it, or, you know, researching this murder. Unknown to me, she bumped that letter up to her editor-in-chief, and 6 months later, he called me up and said, do you have a proposal on this? And I just happened to have one because another friend of mine had said, you know, there's this agent looking for, you know, true crime books. Why don't you hit him up? And I did. And he wanted me to make a bunch of changes to the proposal that I didn't think were right. But he was, in truth, he was correct. I should have made the changes. But anyway, bottom line is, just based on that one-sentence synopsis on a happen chance to, you know, an editor, I ended up getting my first book deal. And so that's how I say I just fell into it. And so it ended up that apparently I was good at it, and they wanted another book. And that was
Sounds
Wages
like
of Sin.
Meant to be.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. By the way, if you're listening live and you want to call in and talk to Susie Spencer, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922, which is, Blog Talk Radio assures me, is a toll-free call in the continental U.S. And also some people, the folks that message in their questions to me via Facebook, maybe you don't have a phone or you're at a day gig and can't make a call. I'll be checking for your comments and questions as well, okay? Well, sounds like the stars lined up and it was meant to be the way this happened. So
apparently,
I think
so.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So listen, I've got a caller on the line already for you, Susie. Hi. Wait. By the way, I hope you like the genie bottle that we're in here. You know,
I
hope you're
love
comfortable
it.
And got a big cushion. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. So we have a call on the line. Welcome to Madame Perry Salon. Come on in. Say hello to Susie. Okay. Can you hear me? Hello. Is this Sherry?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, okay. Hey. All right. Welcome. Okay. We've got a cushion for you in here. This is Sherry Rabinowitz, author and podcaster, of host of Chatting with Sherry. And Sherry, say hello to Susie Spencer.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I'm curious about your story. Because it's usually not that easy to get published. Was it a long process?
In the world of true crime, it can be pretty fast. Well, let me wait. Are you talking about when I first got published or when the books come out? I mean,
when you first got published. The story you were telling.
It was a long, long road. I started writing my first novel in, oh gosh, probably 1976 or so. And then I spent probably 20 years getting rejections, 200 to 300 of them at least. And then it just clicked. It just went with the world of true crime, it just clicked. And then, you know, I got one book, then another, then another, then another, and then another. So it's like, don't throw away anything you write, because someday somebody might want it.
Yeah, seriously.
That's very true.
Well, what we were going to talk about, unless you had another question about writing or publishing, Sherry, one thing I wanted to really focus on tonight, first of all, is the book Breaking Point, which I believe was first published in, what was it, 2005?
Oh, no. The original edition came out in December 2001 or January 2002, just right before Andrea Yates' first trial.
Okay, that's right. And then for some reason, I read it then, And, you know, when like I told you, Susie, I read it, and then for some reason a couple of months ago, I bought it for my Kindle. Although I read the paperback before, and read it again. And then you told me I got the updated version.
Yes.
But I really wanted to explore and the whole situation, the story of Andrea Yates, because, you know, I feel it was so easy. I remember when the story broke. I remember it was so easy for everybody to see, you know, who is this woman? Who is this monster? And for people who don't know, this was the woman, and she lived in Texas.
Clear Lake.
Her husband worked for NASA. Clear Lake, yes. And husband worked for NASA, my wife. And they had 5 children. She was a stay-at-home mom, homeschooler, and just seemed like, from the videos and things you see, the home movies, you know, just a very devoted mother. But she had some issues, and she had some problems with maybe postpartum psychosis and probably some depression. And so when we learned that she had, one morning she waited for her husband to leave for work and then drowned all 5 of her children, you know, it was so easy for everybody to say, well, what a monster, what a horrible person, you know, who would do this? But there was a whole different story to what had led her up to that point. So could you give it to listeners in a
nutshell?
An intro? Yeah.
Well, Andrea Yates grew up in, like you say, in the Houston area. She was a bit of a shining star, but a shy shining star in her high school, because she kept herself, really, you know, had a few close friends and was very shy, but very ambitious and determined. She was in her National Honor Society. She was captain of her swim team. She was valedictorian of her class, and her whole goal was to always help people. She loved helping people, and so she became a nurse and at the famed MD Anderson, you know, hospital in Houston, and dealing with cancer patients. And then she was out swimming one day at her pool, just lying there in the water, you know, relaxing, floating, and there was this guy that she thought was really handsome watching her, and he was thinking, I'd never have a chance with this woman. But she spotted him, and later on she went knocking on his door and said, hey, my car got hit. Do you have any idea who hit it or anything? And they started dating. And this young virgin and Rusty Yates, a guy who had been National Honor Society, football star and all that kind of, you know, scholarship, military scholarship to school. They hit it off and eventually moved in together, which I think just stuns everybody, including me. And then they got married, and Rusty, in the meantime, this is the long version, obviously. But it's such a heartbreaking, fascinating, enlightening story about how this kind of stuff can happen to anybody. Because Rusty was very involved in Fellowship of Christian Athletes and his church in high school, and everybody thought he was really devoted Christian, but he was really a questioning guy. And when he was going to school at Auburn University, he was sitting there one day and heard this guy that he considered a sort of meek, soft-spoken preacher. And I, knowing the guy now, the preacher, I don't know how he came up with that, but he said he was. And the meek, you know, preacher, using Rusty's words, got in a tit-for-tat, so to speak, with another preacher, debating stuff. And Rusty said, as I was listening to this guy, he was saying the same things I would have said to the guy. And so they stayed in touch, the meek and mild preacher and Rusty Yates. And Rusty, to some degree, became a follower of this guy. He was an itinerant preacher who ran all over the world with his family in a bus and telling people that they were going to hell. And for some reason or other, Rusty was pulled to this. so then when he and Andrea got together, Rusty and Andrea, Rusty introduced Andrea to the preacher, whose name is Michael Warnecki, and his wife. And I got a copies of a lot of the letters that the wife Warnecki sent to Andrea, and they were always putting her down, telling her that she was a Jezebel, that she was a sinner, and, you know, just ripping her apart. So then Rusty wanted to follow them so and copy them so that as they had children and they were living in a nice house, Rusty said, I want to live in a bus like the Warneckis. So they basically sold everything, moved into a mobile home, lived in that for a while as Andrea keeps having kids. And with her first son, Noah, when he was born, she started hearing voices or having delusions or where she was saying, you know, get a knife, get a knife, get a knife. But she didn't tell anyone about it. She just kept it to herself. And the bottom line, it was the first signs that she was suffering postpartum psychosis. But Rusty didn't really know about all of this. Then Rusty saw an ad in a newsletter or something where the Warneckis were selling a bus, and Rusty said, let's get rid of the mobile home. Let's move into this bus and be like the Warneckis. Well, the bus was musty and, you know, smelly and had electrical issues. For example, when I visited with Rusty one night and said, can I see the bus? Because he still had it. Can I see the bus? He said, Oh, no. You can't go on it. It's too dangerous. But he had just told me about, you know, working on the bus with his little bitty sons and how they'd be soldering wires and everything. And so I'm thinking, okay, this bus is safe enough for like a five-year-old, but here I am in my 40s at the time, and I can't go on the bus? What's wrong with this picture? But the bottom line is that all of this, the having the babies, the postpartum psychosis, and living in the bus, all came to a head. And she had a nervous breakdown that she called Rusty one day at work when they were living in the bus, which, by the way, they were living in Santa Fe, Texas, which you probably know is where the most recent, you know, school shooting happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this happened, you know, that she had another breakdown, he didn't know what to do. Rusty didn't believe in mental illness. He just thought it was pull yourself, you know, up by your bootstraps, get yourself in gear, get happy. And he walked in, and she was shaking, biting her fingers, and said, I need help. And so not knowing what to do, he took her for a walk in Galveston along the shore. And then he took her to her mom's house where she tried to commit suicide. And then he took her to the hospital, or actually the you know, ambulance took her, and she was put in a mental health facility. And you can stop me and ask me questions because I know this is a long story here.
No, because was that her first suicide attempt at her mother?
There are hints that she may have tried earlier, but mm-hmm. this is the first where she had a knife to her neck. Remember her saying, get a knife, get a knife?
Yeah.
Well, this time she got a knife and she put it to her neck when Rusty came in. Where is she? Found her in the bathroom, and she's saying, no, don't let me. Because she was having these images that she was scared she was going to hurt her children or whatever. And so she felt like if she killed herself, then her children would be safe. But she she went to a good hospital. She went to a good doctor. She got better. But Rusty wanted to have more children. Andrea wanted to do whatever Rusty wanted, and so she went off all of her medications, and she got pregnant again, despite the doctor saying, if you get pregnant again, you know, you're going to have postpartum psychosis again, and once you have it, every bout is worse than the previous.
Oh, but, good grief.
But Rusty described it to me this way. He said, I thought of it as like someone offers you a new, brand new Mercedes-Benz for free. So that's what his children would be, a brand new, you know, Mercedes-Benz, that equivalent of a baby. But if somebody said, if you take this Mercedes, you're going to have the flu for 2 weeks. Hey, wouldn't you take it, is what he said. And he said, that's the way we thought of postpartum psychosis, that we knew there were medications that would get her well, so we'd just take the medicines, you know, and everything would be fine. But Andrea wouldn't really take the medications. She'd often put them in her cheek where, you know, and fake that she had taken them. And so then when she had baby number 5, her sweet little Mary, it all started falling apart again. And then when her father died a few months later, it completely fell apart and she lost it. And Rusty didn't take her back to the original doctor or the original hospital because he was in the middle of a big project, and that was a really far drive. So he found her a doctor and a facility close to their home and started taking her there. Unfortunately, the doctor apparently was not of the quality that her original doctor was, as well as the fact that she would be released whenever her insurance would run out. I think she was allowed like a 10-day stay or something like that. So after 10 days, they would let her go and pronounce her well when she wasn't.
And I gosh, there's just so many. It's like every other sentence is a big road sign, you know, danger bridge out ahead, and everybody's just ignored it and driving on.
Well, a lot of it has to do with ignorance about mental health issues, and that's one of the good things about this book, so to speak, is that when it first came out, it allowed me to go on radio and TV shows talking about mental health, so that people are more aware of the signs and the symptoms and know to get help, that postpartum psychosis isn't the baby blues or anything. It is an acute illness that if someone has it, you need to get them help immediately because it's a matter of life and death. And it's no shame.
And that's true. And, you know, no matter what, and one of the reasons why I've had, you know, I'm having some extra episodes of the show similar to this is because I think, too, when you have, so many, like, whether it's school shootings or other shootings or suicides, or one of my listeners who is a high school teacher, Brett Wright, he gets very involved with his students and gets very concerned about teen suicides in there. And there are so many things we don't understand, and there are so many times where no matter what we talk about when a crisis happens, the crisis occurs, and then we all talk about here's the hotline, here's the information for this or that or the other, and, you know, we need to erase the stigma of mental health. You know, even First Lady Rosalynn Carter, that was her platform, was mental health. But I think, too, these are all tragic situations. But then I think, too, with people who are very famous, very well-to-do, seem to be successful, like Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain. I know that's a different situation than Andrea Yates. But then people think, you know, these kind of things can happen to anyone, you know, just any kind of psychosis or problems. And I've got a comment here from a listener, Drew Fenton. And she listened to the story. She says, I'm listening. And she said, the story's so heartbreaking. And she said, you know, this is, and she added in, this is Mental Health Awareness Month. And as a mom who has lost a child, and Drew, I'm so very sorry about that because I know you've mentioned that, but I don't know a lot about your child. But it says, as a mom who's lost a child, this is sad on so many levels. Most of the info on Randy, I think she means Rusty, did not come out in the press, but it was much easier to blame crazy. It's so easy to gloss over warning signs until something horrible happens. Yeah, Drew, you're right. You're right.
Well, and that's, like I say, Rusty did not believe in mental illness, and there are so many people who don't believe that. I was on a radio show one time with, oh, God, I've forgotten her name, and she's so famous, it's ridiculous, a tall, skinny pundit for the Republicans, or actually for the Tea Party.
Oh, Coulter?
Yeah, Ann Coulter.
Ann Coulter, yeah.
And she does not believe in mental illness. And at least she didn't back then. So I don't know about now, but she was like, you know, no, this is ridiculous. But it does exist, just like cancer
mm-hmm.
exists, just like high cholesterol
mm-hmm.
exists, just like, you know, heart disease exists, brain disease exists. And it can often be treated or at least controlled. But
mm-hmm.
it is confusing when it happens to someone you love or even to yourself, because after the Andrea Yates trial and covering that, I did not realize how depressed I was. And actually, Lucy Puryear, who was the expert witness for the defense, came to me several months after the trial and said, Susie, you do not know how depressed you are. You have got to get help. And she hooked me up with a psychiatrist to get help. So
mm-hmm.
lots of times we just know things don't feel right, but we don't know what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then also sometimes when we think we're doing the right thing, like Rusty did with getting her help, he said, I didn't know, you know, there were a difference between psychiatrists. I thought that they were all good. Hey, they're MDs, you know. Well, they're not
mm-hmm.
all good. And
mm-hmm.
and when you talk about suicide, I have been working off and on for 18 years now a book about a 12-year-old suicide. And I met with her parents the other day, and we were going over how they tried and tried and tried to get her help. But when they would talk to the doctors would just blow them off, or the insurance wouldn't cover things. And so it becomes that you have to become an advocate out there fighting, just like if you were
mm-hmm.
on the battlefield, you know, fighting, you know, whatever, and, you know, having all your soul going in there trying to save America or whatever, it's sort of the same thing. You have to go in there with a battle, you know, mindset that I am going to be the advocate for this person. I know I'm going overboard and sounding ridiculous, but it just hurts me so that all these people are suffering and we don't know what to do. And even though I have dealt with mental health issues for years in my career and in my personal life, it's still confusing when you see something going wrong and you don't know what to do.
Oh yeah, I mean it's like Drew who was listening when she said it was heartbreaking, and I don't think you can go on and on enough because obviously we still need a lot more education and a lot more understanding and paying attention. By the way, if you're listening live and you want to talk to Susie Spencer, the number is 646-716-9922. It's toll free in the U.S. and I do have another caller here to speak with you, Susie. Hello, and welcome to Madame Perry's Salon, and come on in and say hello to Susie. Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hi.
Is it me? Hi, Susie.
Yes, come on in. Say hello to Susie.
How are you?
I'm I'm fine. I thought I was fine until I started listening to you.
Oh, no. Yeah, you're fine. Okay.
I'm beginning to wonder.
Okay, this is Duffy in Georgia. Okay. Hi.
Yes.
So do you have a question for Susie?
Yes. I know what you're talking about with different psychologists and psychiatrists. I've been to several, and it doesn't take long, just a few minutes, to figure out that this person really doesn't get it. I'm not going to get any help here.
Mm-hmm.
I need to talk to somebody else, somebody that will listen and somebody that understands what I'm going through. And I was wondering, I don't know if you've visited suspects in jail or people who have actually been convicted in jail or at home or what, but it seems like when I've seen interviews with people that you can pretty much realize that all of these people are suffering from some type of mental disorder. And I was wondering if you felt the same way or if you'd seen any indications of that. I think pretty much all crime is a mental health issue.
Yeah, it's sort of confusing about, you know, the insanity plea and knowing the difference between right and wrong, because, yes, I have visited with convicted criminals and have explored their mental health records, their psychiatric evaluations. And generally there is some sort of abuse in their background, be it physical, emotional, you know, or sexual, or drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And like with Justin Thomas, the killer in my first book, he was a drug addict, and he had watched his mother attempt suicide numerous times over his childhood. And then when he was in prison, he learned that his father killed himself, I believe with a gun that Justin had given him or something. And when I met Justin the first time, I thought, this is a screwed up guy, but if he gets the right mental health care, he can be a productive citizen. And he told me that after his father killed himself, he went to the prison, you know, doctor, said, I need help, I need help, I need counseling. And they just said, oh, you know, of course you're grieving after your father did this. It's no big deal. Well, then Justin, I got transferred from Texas to California to go on trial for another murder there. And I saw him there after he'd spent 10 years in solitary confinement. And he was a totally different man. He was a man that I felt was so insane that he would be a danger to get out in the world again. But I could go through every one of my books and point to the mental health issues in there. And I want to emphasize that just because you have a mental health issue does not mean you're going to be a criminal or a killer.
Right.
One of the people that I most admire is a writer here in Austin, Texas, with the Austin American Statesman, who has done so many award-winning exposés. She is brilliant and has so much talent. I wish I had an inkling of the talent she does. And she is bipolar. And she talks about how the newspaper stuck with her when she was having her breakdown and supported her, and now she is a terrific mom, does charity work constantly, does fabulous reporting. Just because you're bipolar or schizophrenic or whatever, or just depressed, you know, manic depressive or whatever, it does not mean you can't be a productive citizen. You can be. It's just a matter of getting treatment. And I like you, I have gone through numerous therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers. And you just have to go until you find one that clicks. But, you know, don't give them just one or two chances. See them for a little while. Because, you know, they may click after a while because they're getting to know you just like you're getting to know them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Well,
Duffy, thank you so much for calling. Oh, you're not through? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've noticed the ones that work are like angels. When it does click, it just it amazes me. And another thing that amazes me, I think of all of prose writing, the ones that I think are the absolute best and the most interesting to me are true crime writers, because you have to have you go through the gamut of emotions, and you have to put them in check. When I met Truman Capote, he liked to say that when I wrote In Cold Blood, I didn't use the word I one time. And I thought, this is not a true crime. That whole story of him writing that, I think has to do with his fascination with Perry Smith and the depth of that writing, and he certainly wasn't a true crime writer.
Yeah.
He just put everything
he
had into it. And
yeah, he sure did.
People that write true crime have to have to be able to see things from so many different angles, and it's so tricky because you're telling the truth. You know, you have to get everything right, or you're not going to be successful. It's probably not the thing for you. But I'm going to get all of your books.
Well, thank you.
Your approach to it from hearing you talk is just it's compassionate, but it's objective, and also your thoughts about the mental health issue for criminals and victims.
The way they
interact together is so fascinating and important.
Well, thank you.
No
I
kidding.
Appreciate your kind
that's
words.
True. Duffy, thank you so much, Duffy. And you know what? Since you brought that up, that's a perfect time to say that Susie's website is Susie Spencer, and that's SusieSpencer.com, SusieSpencer.com. And you can go to her website. Plus, I will be sharing all of Susie's social media and where you can find her books all on my social media. I'll be saying where you can find her books, where you can find her. And by the way, if you're listening live tonight on July the 9th, tomorrow night, Tuesday, July the 10th, if you're in Austin, go to Book People at 7 p.m. Central. Susie's going to be talking with novelist May Cobb about her book, her novel Big Woods. But so you'll get a double treat. You get May Cobb and Susie Spencer, and Book People. So that's a, you know, win-win-win.
Yeah, with Maze, you're going to get free wine and free cookies, I believe.
Oh, good.
Besides that, Big Woods is an incredible book. I grew up in East Texas, and May did too, and it's a thriller set in East Texas that I hung on every page. I also edit a lot of books, and I did not find one boring page in that book. It's just incredible.
Whoa.
I think true crime friends will love it too.
Okay, so get Susie's books. I'm so sorry, we're running out of time. It just flew by too fast for me. So thank you, Susie, for being here. Please say you'll come back again sometime.
I would love to.
Oh, thank you. And hey, maybe, you know, if we're kind of pouncing now since you've been on the podcast and we happen to have a mutual friend, maybe you can use your, your author showbiz influence to get Mae Cobb to come on here as well.
I think we could work that out. And also,
okay.
I want to say, I've forgotten her name and I thought I had written it down. The woman whose daughter had died.
Drew. I'm sorry, I was wrong. It was her son. I was just, sorry. I think I was just having a showbiz moment here talking to you and forgot. It's her son, not her daughter.
Okay.
I was sorry.
Okay.
I made a mistake.
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm thinking about you, and I am so sorry for that horrible, horrible loss.
Okay. Thank you. And she says, thank you for that. She appreciates it. So get Susie's books. I'm sorry we're out of time, but hopefully she'll come back soon. And Susie, I'm gonna sign off with a little personal chat with me and Susie here. Since my mother knows your friend Diana's mother, my mother used to go up with her years ago and sit in on the friend Diana was on Hee Haw. She was one of the pretty blondes on Hee Haw, Diana Goodman. And Susie Spencer, you tell me you were in her wedding?
Yeah, we both lived in Los Angeles,
so cool.
And she was my best friend out there.
Well, wait a minute. Were you the friend that with B.J. Thomas?
No.
Okay. I've only read the first three chapters of the book. Okay, I'm not gonna start any kind of showbiz rumors or anything, you know, to damage your reputation.
I was more like the Rhoda character to Diana. I would never compare Diana to Mary Richards, but I was the sort of nerdy best friend. Diana would introduce me to people and then would, you know, meet them again. They never remembered me. They always remembered Diana. So.
Oh, I know. That's my part, you know, because people say things like my friends that are newspaper and magazine editors, and they'll say, hey, do you know so-and-so? And I think so. Well, I got three tickets to go see them, you know. Okay. And I'm the same. You know, they hang around and don't worry about me. I'm just sitting here enjoying the show. You just talk to him. And in fact, actually, one time when my grandmother died, and Diana and her mother were at the funeral home.
Oh.
And, of course, this was about, this might have been around 1984, 85. And, you know, Diana always, well, everybody in her family, her mother's gorgeous too, but she had on a short black leather mini. It was so cute. And my mother's cousin said to my mom, you've got friends like that and you never let me know? She goes, of course I didn't let you know.
Well, let's give her a plug. Her book is called, what is it, Hollywood Lights and Nashville Nights by Diana Goodman.
Yes, Diana Goodman and Victoria Hallman. So I know she had a book signing last Saturday morning in Fayetteville, and I think I'm going to be talking to her maybe sometime this week and get her on. But, yeah, we'll give her that Hollywood Lights and Nashville Nights. And it's quite a book. Diana's a very – I don't know Victoria Hallman, but I know Diana's quite a fascinating lady. So, yeah, we'll have to have a reunion on here sometime, okay?
I haven't seen her in decades. That'd be great.
All right, we'll have a pajama party on Madame Perry's Salon. How about that?
That sounds wonderful.
All right, so I'll be giving you all the information. Get all Susie Spencer's books, and thank you so very much. And as I always say, everybody's that way. Bye, Susie.
Bye-bye.